So I think we'll get started. I'm Craig Spencer, and my wife and I, Susie, are kind of co-teaching this course. And I know some of you are kind of coming and going and with the classes. So this is the third class. So I thought I'd just take a couple minutes to review the first couple classes, put it in context of what we're going to talk about today. The title of our course is Evolution, Creation, and Alpine Wildflowers. So we're covering a fair amount of territory. So we started out looking at the relationship between science and religion, and how they may or may not relate, and talked about three different models. Are they in conflict? Are they independent? Are they integrated? So we talked a bit about that. Surveys of the American public would suggest that 65% view science and religion as in conflict, to the extent where choosing one or the other, but both maybe not possible. So we kind of explored that, and so today what we're going to do, start out with at least, is talk a little bit about some other issues that might be involved with the possibility of conflict. Before we get to that, so last time and then we kind of went through Evolution 101, Darwin's process. We talked about these four steps, kind of how evolution works. So tonight we're going to follow up on a couple of issues and then get to the wildflowers. So some issues, the first one, again, it might be involved in conflict, has to do with this notion of variation, which is fundamental to evolution. What's the source of the variation? Where does the variation come from?
Genetics,
okay. And genetics are determined by our DNA. So if this process that Darwin first described, this is today, all these, 30 million species, and Homo sapiens is one, and the skyrocket that we're going to see tomorrow on our hike just happens to be another one. Evolved from some common ancestor. The variation that we see today, as described by Darwin, is just, and supported by evolutionary biologists, is from chance random mutation to the DNA. So that raises some ethical, moral, possibly theological issues, the source of variation. Richard Dawkins wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker. Any of you heard of that? So if there is a watchmaker, according to Dawkins, he's blind, because the basic variation that's being operated upon comes about randomly. So that's one issue that I thought we might talk a little bit about today. I wasn't really planning on spending a lot of time on this one, but we could if you'd like to. I think there are some issues with how our species fits in to the scheme. And the third issue, that may be contributing to some of the uneasiness, actually has to do with step three. So let's review step three a little bit. What's natural selection?
Survival of the fittest.
Survival of the fittest. Okay, so which species survived? Which individual survived?
Healthy.
The healthy ones?
The ones most suited to adapt to whatever's changing in the environment.
The ones more suited, and in Darwin's 1859 explanation, the ones best suited, as he envisioned it, were the ones that were the superior competitors. It's a fairly ruthless process. The vast majority of all species that have ever lived are now extinct. So the ones that are here are the survivors. So why did they survive? Was it because of a process that favored, can you read the title? The selfish gene. Is that what this process favors? Highly competitive individuals survive that are selfish. Alan talked the other day that we have this urge to survive, but in our survival, it's resulting in the death of others. So, quote from Tennyson, Nature read, tooth and claw. Have you heard that expression before? This process. So these are three issues. So let's just start out just for a few minutes here at the beginning, maybe get in little groups. Talk about these three. Are these issues that you think are things that we want to talk about tonight that concern you or not? And then we'll kind of go from there. So just take a few minutes, threes or fours, and chat a little bit about them.
Come talk to you, Jim.
Woods or something like that, would have been dead a long time ago. I like this life. Because natural selection.
So, I'm a family physician, and I talk to
Time that we've been alive, man's been alive, we've never
Okay, I'm gonna cut you off.
Yeah.
Sorry. But when I agreed to take on this teaching responsibility, I was encouraged to include some discussion in the class. And so I think there's a lot of food for thought, things to talk about. So I wanted to take a little time for that this morning, or this afternoon, this evening. So I definitely want to spend some time here tonight. Any thing that came up on number one or two that you wanted to raise for the whole group? Okay. So, is this process a ruthless process that leads to selfish individuals, highly competitive individuals? And when I first started teaching ecology, the ecology textbooks, the competition chapter was this thick.
Wow.
And the cooperation chapter was about this thick. Now, they're almost identical in thickness. And so this notion of survival, what leads to survival, it might be superior competitors. But increasingly, we're finding that the survivors often are relying on other species for their own survival, and it's a beneficial thing. So can you think of examples where two species are interacting and it's not competition, it's cooperative, it's mutual benefits?
Well, bees and pollination.
Okay, so the bee and the flower, they're both benefiting? Mm-hmm.
There's some sea animals that have little things hooked to them.
Yeah. Oh, like the remora fish and the
yeah.
Shark. Okay.
Eels and
sharks.
Cleaner fish.
Cleaner fish.
Yes.
Yep. Other marine animals. The coral organism actually is a symbiotic relationship between an invertebrate, an animal, and algae. The color in the coral is from the algae, and so without the algae, the coral doesn't live. Without the coral animal, the algae doesn't live. Ruminants, cows, deer, actually ants, termites, how do they live?
Ourselves? We're full of
bacteria. The digestion process doesn't work very well. We provide the energy for our gut flora, but we can't digest cellulose, nor can termites. And so the more we look, the more we find that survival, that this process of evolution is going to lead not just to selfish character traits, but also cooperation. Now, whether this is contributing to any of this, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe that's not an issue. But I find it interesting. And so, some of the most recent work on cooperation comes from studying alpine wildflowers. And it turns out that that the high alpine environment is very stressful. A very short growing season. One of the biggest problems, actually, beyond the short growing season, is incredibly dry. In the wintertime, it's very dry, and above tree line, in the summertime, it can be very, very, it's very high intense radiation up there, so it's an incredibly stressful environment, and the species, the plants that survive, cooperate, and so I've got a few Absolutely.
Well, we can't allow the cooperation to proceed because that's in conflict with our economic model of competition.
Oh, boy, okay. Tie it into economics, same root word. So here's the coral. This is healthy coral with the color. Have you heard of coral bleaching? That's what it looks like without the algae. And it's not going to survive.
Do you know how to get rid of that power off?
I don't. I know if we push it, it'll go off. I'm going to skip over this. Okay, so the alpine environment. One of my favorite places. And the plants that survive up there are incredibly well adapted to this stressful environment. High species diversity in the alpine. Yeah, and recent work by Ray Calloway from the University of Montana and others is finding this mutualistic interaction. So, as a scientist, can't get by without showing you some data. So here's some data. So in low elevation environments, they did some experiments where they took this diverse plant community and they removed one species. Zoop, it's gone. And then they looked at the response. Okay, here's the pink wintergreen plant. And after they removed that one plant, see what happened? The one that remained was stimulated. So here's the data. Okay, with this is the plant, number of plants flowering. When the community was intact, you know, about 5% of the plants flowered. But when they removed one, what happened?
The competitor plant flowered more often.
The remaining plants were stimulated. Okay, remove another species, it was beneficial. Okay, so this would be competition, right? Mm. Definitely competition that this species is competing with that one, and it's a negative interaction. Okay, now let's go to the high alpine and remove one species. And what happened? Not as many flowers, a bunch of them died. So here was the control when the community was intact, when they removed one, had a negative effect on the rest of the community. So in this case, they're not competitors. So the fully functioning community, a cooperative community, actually led to higher survival of the entire community.
Do they know why that is?
What kind of process?
Could be lots of different reasons. Wind, the taller plants would tend to accumulate more snow, and snow is a good insulator. There could be some nutrient exchange between plants. Those experiments are being done right now, trying to sort out what the benefit is. And this research team went all over the world. And the high alpine communities, this is this positive effect of the neighbors. In almost every case, the effect of the neighbors was positive. But in the low elevation sites, in a lot of cases, the neighboring species had a negative effect. So that's kind of the end of the evolution unit. So now we're going to just talk about the basic ecology of these wildflowers. So Susie, you want to?
Okay. Well, I was just visiting with Jan a little bit about hiking to Holden, and she had done that many times in the last 70 plus years. And one reason I like wildflowers is like when you're hiking, you have a friend along. You know, you see friends from year to year, you know, and they look different. There might be more of them, less of them. And so getting to know a little bit about the alpine flowers is important. Those of you who are here for the first time, I'm not a botanist. I'm a family physician, so this is just a hobby I have. So I'm no expert, but these are some things that I've learned over the years from a friend that's a botanist and from Craig. What I wanted to talk about just a little bit is when you think about the alpine flowers, is how do they survive in such harsh conditions? They're dealing with temperature changes, extreme changes, snow, drought. You know, people don't think of a drought, but sometimes a drought at times and lots of wind. And so the obvious is that they tend to be shorter. You know, you don't have big, tall flowers at the top of the alpine. They tend to cuddle down close to the ground, and they're waiting for their little environment to change, to get warmer, to collect some water, whatever it is, to grow. Also, what I found really, really interesting is that the cells of alpine plants are full of a different kind of sugars that act as a cellular antifreeze. So that's why they can live without freezing sometimes when they're, you know, in the spring when they're coming up, or, in those change of seasons. So they have this kind of natural antifreeze. And these sugars allow the plants to survive and grow in temperatures below freezing. So these plants, when they're underneath the snow, they start growing. Which is, I think, quite amazing. Also, alpine plants also can achieve maximum photosynthesis rates at cooler temperatures than regular plants. So that's an adaptation that they've made over the years. And they start growing before many of the snow go. You know, before the snow goes away. If you've ever been hiking, I know up in Holden, as you get up to near Holden Lake, and the snow's going out, and right on the edge of the snow, you'll see a pasque flower coming up. You might see a globe flower. You might see a lily, an avalanche lily, or a glacier lily, coming up right through the snow. It's kind of packed down and ice-like. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Okay, just at that soft edge, they already start coming up. So that's pretty amazing. Also, when the melting of that snow cover, there's a rise in temperature to 32 degrees. It softens kind of the wind overwintering buds. And those buds can grow very early and come up through that snow. So that's where it's quite deep. Another thing that's kind of interesting is there's large ice crystals as those mounds of snow are melting. And the rooting spring snow in that rotting, actually kind of old snow, allows the blue-green light to penetrate, like, because of the change in the crystals, like 6 feet below. So that's how some of these plants are able to start growing earlier. The other thing I want to talk about, so those are just some of the things that they can do. They can do lots of other things too. One of the other things is like the buttercups that you see, those yellow, they're real close to the ground, and they're kind of shiny. The buttercup, it's kind of like a solar collector. And, pardon? Is there one?
Yeah, just
they're like a solar collector, and the center of the plant can be 5 to 10 degrees warmer than the air temperature around them. So sometimes you'll notice that insects, you'll see insects like to be in there. And so that brings more insects to pollinate, and there's other advantages, but they have warmth, increased warmth, and I think that's kind of amazing also. Also, some of them, the buds around the flowers are red, and that helps them be able to grow earlier. And sometimes that red also that you'll see in alpine plants protects them against the harmful effects of high UVA, UV radiation. So, because like Craig said, they're exposed. But one thing I wanted to go back to, can we go back just to the moss camping? The moss camping.
Yep.
Kind of the, when you're in the alpine, and unfortunately when we hike to Holden, we won't see this, but just so you'll know in the future, the moss campion is kind of the the first plant you really want to know about, because it's a really important one. They're cushion plants. So if you didn't have the pink flowers, it almost looks like moss, and they'll be in, you know, they'll be on the rocks, and they're kind of in a mound. But it's not moss. It actually, you know, they flower. And they have learned to grow in an environment that is like sometimes 50% just covered in rocks and small, you know, soil. Very little soil, mostly rocks. And these cushion plants dominate these windswept areas, and they stay very low to the ground, and they aren't so exposed. They also have one of the longest growing seasons, sometimes up to 100 days, compared to some of the other alpine flowers that have a growing season of less than 60 days. So they have a longer growing season. But these mats, one reason they're able to survive is that they look very delicate when you see them, but they can have a tap root that will go down 6 feet. And there are some books where they show a cutaway. What's also amazing is that they are very slow growers. So when you are up in the alpine, you don't want to step on these things. You don't want to have your picnic lunch on them. Some of these larger mounds are 150 to 200 years old. Most of these will take 30 years before they'll even make a flower. They'll get to be about a silver dollar size before they'll have a flower. So, these are like, you know, reverence in the alpine area. You don't want to step on them. You don't want to, they're very important. And then what's even more important or interesting is that the flowers, they said that like early explorers would look at this, because what happens is they tend to flower on the south side, you know, where they get more of the sun and where it's warmer, south facing. And then the other areas will get too much sun radiation, or maybe they will get drier, more wind, and they'll start dying, and they'll end up kind of cascading over many, many years down the mountain over the rocks, because the flowers will kind of, everything will kind of go to the south side, and then they'll keep moving down. But it amazes me when I've been up there with my friend, and she'll say, you know, that it's probably 150 years old what you're looking at. You know, it's kind of like looking at, you know, a huge trees, you know, and everyone thinks that, you know, those are wonderful, but these little plants are pretty amazing. And as they grow, they are like a nursery for the alpine, because they break down rock, they trap soil, they trap nutrients, and pretty soon you start having flowers come up. You get little sedges and grasses. You can, here it looks like you're probably getting, I don't know, maybe a, here's a buttercup. These might be anemones, alpine anemones, but they kind of start a nursery. They a whole area, and then a whole new community over time will be there. And you'll see these areas, and they're really, I don't know, they're fantastic, I think.
So, yeah, did you already talk about how climate change is affecting them?
Mm-hmm. I can't really tell you. I'm sure that there's some people that are, you know, studying that. I mean, with time.
Well, climate change.
Because if it's going to change.
The alpine, the amount of area above tree line is shrinking because the forests are able to live at higher and higher elevations because the temperatures are milder. You know,
so
trees can't survive up there because the growing season is so short. Well, the growing season is getting longer now. And so the forest, the tree line is rising, which means the alpine environment is getting smaller.
And that, with that getting smaller, animals that live there, the mountain goats in Glacier Park and other animals are losing their environment where they like to live.
As long as the buttercup is up there, can you talk about how a white flower raises its temperature 10 degrees?
The buttercup is a yellow.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's a...
It has to do with the shape.
Well, the shape of that pass flower.
But this is a pass flower.
Okay, thanks.
This is a western pass flower, and if we get up to the lake, there are some of these coming through. And this is really a sub-alpine species. It's not an alpine. We won't be in the alpine.
You said it was the buttercup that was so much warmer.
Yeah, that they can, yeah, and it has to do with its shape and the way it catches the sun. And,
okay.
They're millimeters deep, but the temperature inside is 5 to 10 degrees warmer, which allows it to be pollinated more readily. Yes.
I've always wondered about the variety of colors in wildflowers. Is it to attract different insects, or I see a lot of blue flowers right now.
Along the way, you see a lot of pensaments. I do know that, what was I reading just recently? There are certain colors and smells that attract different insects to flowers. Hummingbirds don't need a smell. They don't like, a fragrance doesn't bring them, whereas it brings bees. So different alpine flowers, and I can't tell you which ones, are pollinated by different kinds of insects. Yes, that's true. Tomorrow we may see, I think these are the leaves of stonecrop. You're not getting the yellow flowers, and they're succulent, so that's another adaptation, is to hold, moisture in their leaves. This is the bottom of Luisia, which we will see tomorrow, lots of it, and it's one of my favorites.
So they almost look like desert plants, thick, fleshy.
And you're going to see some really big ones of these. I mean, they're just gorgeous, and then they send up a stalk that doesn't have any leaves and then has a petaled flower, small flower that has little pink lines, veins in it.
We actually wanted to take you up to the alpine environment. But
you can't
it's
get
covered
from
with
here.
Snow right now. So I'll come back in August and we can get up there. Mike Mullen and I went searching for it this morning, actually, up the mountain behind the cabins, and actually had some issues finding the trails. But we actually got up to some areas that had these cushion communities.
Here's the yellow flower of stonecrop. Mm-hmm. This is the succulent leaves.
But it was...
And stonecrop you see in very dry areas that are now, up in the south.
You actually get an interesting view of the valley from up. But it's not on the trail system. Paul, we're not encouraging this.
So is this right? On the way to Lyman Lake?
No, they were on Martin's Ridge.
Martin's Ridge.
So, but our hike tomorrow, for those that are interested, we'll be going up to...
Holden Lake.
Holden Lake, sorry.
And there is some just spectacular, picture was taken on Sunday, of the scarlet or red columbine.
So this is on the trail, the Holden Lake, that we're doing tomorrow.
This is the Luisia, the bitterroot, and you can see, I'm going to try to find some hand lenses. I'm hoping that maybe Narnia has some. But when you get a close look, it's pretty phenomenal. One of my favorites.
Go back and let's look at the stripes in those petals.
And we're gonna, when we hike tomorrow, the goal isn't to get somewhere fast. That's why I like looking at alpine flowers, is it slows you down. And no one knows that you like to go slow and that you're catching your breath and you can stop and I'll bring some books along. But when you look at them close up and you see there's the veins and then the pistil and the stamens here. Stamens are the male part, pistil in the middle. It's just amazing, the colors and just the beauty of them. We'll see some orchids hopefully tomorrow. This is the foam flower. And you can see this also. It's more of a woodland flower, so we'll see that on the way up.
So the first part of the hike will be going through woodland communities and then getting into that.
And we'll see wintergreens in the woodland communities. If we're lucky, we only found one of these on the way up before you hit the avalanche to Holden Lake. This is a calypso or fairy slipper orchid.
So that was Sunday?
Sunday. So we're hoping it's still there. It's just about this. Most people, I'm sure, walk right by it. One person that didn't walk by it on Sunday was Larry Rasmussen. He said, "Did you see that calypso orchid?" I said, "Yes, I did." So, it's very, very small, but it's exquisite.
So this is Holden Lake.
And here are some lilies coming up through the snow.
Around the lake.
The Pasque flower. And this is the flower that some weeks from now will have that real, it looks like hair or goat's beard, wind flower, and that's how the seeds get spread around. This was Sunday.
So for those that are planning to go the whole way, we'll definitely want to pack a lunch.
Everyone will want to pack a lunch. I think the plan is to meet at the hiking house at 10:15 or so. So we're starting later so people can go to Bible study. And bring lunch, water bottle, if you like, don't like bugs, bug spray, hat, all that kind of stuff. And then we will just meander up and see as much as we can. If people, after an hour, they've had enough, they can turn around, because everyone will sign in on their own, so then you can turn around and sign out when you get back. And we'll just keep going as long as people want to go. Tonight, Craig and I are going to put together a list of flowers that you most likely that you will see. And so that if you want to learn one or two, you'll have the names so that you'll remember them. And I just wanted to let you know that in the bookstore, there's a wonderful book written.
Good, put those lights on.
Is it Roxanne?
Yeah, Roxanne, I think.
The Golden Wildflowers?
Yeah, they're just pencil drawings, but this is a really nice book. It has all the common things. I've used it this week because I'm used to Rocky Mountain, Glacier Park kind of flowers, and so there were some new ones. And most of them were in here. It was pretty good. What's nice about this book is if you like to, you can take it home and you can use some colored pencils and color in your favorite one or two. And then you bring it back, and every year you learn one or two more. That's how you do it. The other thing that's available in the library is a more extensive, Barbara Collins from California Lutheran did this kind of key, and it's a little bit more of a key to all the flowers that, most of the flowers that are found around here. And it's quite good. And then here's one that is Mountain Plants of the Pacific Northwest. This is in the library. It has nice pictures and then descriptions. So it's a good book, and I've kind of looked at books for Holden, and then I go back to this and look, and then I have some other books that I brought that I used it back in Montana, but this is a good book. So this is in the library too. This one is right when you first walk in the library. It says reference section, do not remove. So I'll go put it back, but it's right there. It's kind of, and then they have it in a holder, so it's a nice one to go and look at it. And it usually tells you kind of an area where maybe they've been seen. But I know when to Heart Lake yesterday, we made a list of 44 flowers, and there were some that I'll tell you tomorrow. There will be some that I can't tell you what they are, especially these teeny tiny white weedy things. So we'll just pass them by. But you'll probably see at least 40 if you go most of the way tomorrow.
So you went to 40 to 50. And then you found 44 flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my. I missed some.
Now, the reason we're not doing the Heart Lake Trail is that there are periods of time where there's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
On the way to Holden, there's always something going on, and they're more spectacular. More colors, more variety.
The Holden Lake Trail, you start out in a woodland environment, and then you go up some switchbacks and get into some rocky subalpine, and then you go back into some old growth woodlands.
So you see quite a variety, more of a variety.
Sunday too.
Nice variety.
Later than
yeah.
And then you get up top and there's snow and past flowers and spring beauties.
And think there, we might see some things that weren't there on Sunday, which would be fun. Mm-hmm. And I'll bring some books along so that we can, when we stop for a break or whatever, we can look them up and figure out what they were. Today I just went to Monkey Falls with Paul and Susan, and I came back and I know two new plants now. So I'll have those for tomorrow, I hope.
What about trillium?
Trillium are gone.
Yeah.
That's more of a spring flower. I mean, earlier spring. So you won't see any trillium. We didn't see any trillium.
We'll see the leaves.
When you go out, whichever direction it is that you go, that way, to go to Holden, that way. There are some bunch berries. There's the queen cup, which is quite white, but it doesn't have three petals. But it's in the lily family, and it's pretty spectacular. You'll see that as we walk along that first mile or so.
Were the trilliums blooming when you...
We get to see trillium
in June.
We came on June
9th. Yeah. Those are really the early, and they are beautiful.
But we got some of this to grow in our house, in our yard near Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
They're gorgeous.
Yeah, they're nice.
Susie, you said meet at the hike house, but this is the Ark.
It's the hike house.
Okay.
Meet at the hike house and sign yourself in. And that way, when you want to turn around and come back, you can come back and sign yourself out, and I don't have to be responsible for, who came back, who didn't come back. You can do your own.
Do
So
you aren't going to go all the way to the lake.
I'm hoping that some of us will, but we might. Maybe we'll be so into, we'll see so many flowers, and it'll be late enough that we need to just turn around and come back.
And it
so.
May depend on how hot it is.
Mm-hmm. How hot it? Because it's gonna. Since we're waiting till after Bible study,
right.
It's gonna be hotter. So be sure you have a hat. And
yeah,
if you want to sign, Paul made a sign up so we can sign up. If you want
to
sign
up. Do you have a time when you expect to be back, or are you not gonna put that pressure? On?
By dinner. I mean, it's a long, you know. But leaving that late, you know, but yeah, we're planning on getting back by dinner.
How long did it take us to get down on us?
Oh, it doesn't take very long to get down. I suppose it took an hour and a half.
Yes, but everyone has
2 hours.
Yes.
But we'll go. I will go slow. I mean, because we're there to see the flowers.
Just tell
and if we don't, and if we don't get, if we don't, if there's a group of us that don't make it to the lake, that's perfectly okay. You're going to see some gorgeous views.
I think the majority of flowers are before the avalanche.
Yes.
So that would cut off a couple of miles.
Just tell them the snack bar closes at 4.
I haven't been to the snack bar yet.
If you haven't packed a lunch, there's stuff out.
Yeah, in the morning at breakfast time, so pack your lunch there.
Bags to put it in and stuff. And we'll bring some water filtration units. So if you have a water bottle, we'll be able to fill it up a couple times.
Yeah, because it'll be hot, so we'll be able to give you extra water.
You only need to bring one water bottle.
Can I ask a flower question?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you don't know the answer to this, but I live in Minnesota, and you were talking about Trillium, and
yes, you have Trillium there.
Is that similar that there's like stonecrop that looks kind of like something I've seen?
Yeah, and stonecrop looks, there's a domesticated stonecrop that you
right.
can plant in your garden. Yeah.
So are some of these species kind of like mm-hmm. pervasive in all
yes.
different kinds of
like
plants?
Indian paintbrush. We're going to see
mm-hmm.
Indian paintbrush. You're going to see orange, and you're going to see pink, and you're going to see red. And you can go down to the Colorado Rockies to see that. You can go lots of different places.
Yeah.
But when you go clear up, when you go to the alpine, you only see you don't see that other places. I mean, you might see another alpine. When you're in the true alpine, you don't see those flowers at other lower elevations.
I noticed yesterday going up to Heart Lake,
mm-hmm.
and the lupin is this big, but on the North Shore of Duluth, near Duluth, the lupin is this big.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's just the impact of the environment on how
yeah.
the plant thrives.
Sure.
So one time I was, I think, at Mount St. Helens, and we bought alpine lupin seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I live in Seattle, and so we're at a lower
mm-hmm.
elevation, and I couldn't get them to grow.
I don't know why they sell those sort of flowers.
I know.
Because
so
usually they don't.
Because they have to freeze at a cold.
There's all sorts of reasons. And most of, I mean, what's really good about the Holden book
mm-hmm.
is she will tell you in here, don't try to dig this up and grow, because it has to be, it feeds off of roots of other plants.
Mm-hmm.
It can't plant this.
Mm-hmm.
She'll say, we have this
right.
one in our gardens around Holden, but this one, don't try to do anything, because
right.
you can't transplant them. So
yeah.
a lot of them don't grow except, you know,
right.
in that sort of environment. So
some of those succulents, though,
mm-hmm.
sedums.
Yeah, those you can, and there are a lot of domesticated ones, too. There's domesticated penstemons. We're going to see several
uh-huh.
penstemons tomorrow.
Right.
There are domesticated ones
yeah.
that you can grow. Yeah.
They're just not as pretty.
No, but a lot, but most of the flowers you can't transplant and get
right.
them to grow, unfortunately.
What about Lithodora?
Lithodora.
It's a succulent. It has little green flowers.
Didn't see that.
I used it in rock gardens.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic, actually, that we can't cultivate something. The only place you can find them is you've got to go out there and hike to them.
But the main thing is just to make it fun tomorrow. We'll give you a list, and I would just encourage, if you come on the hike, try to learn one flower, two or three, you know, just try to do one and write some notes about it, so that the next time you go a place, you come here, or you go on another hike, you go, I remember that penstemon. That's, you know, and it might not be the same species, because there's lots of penstemons, but you know it's a penstemon, and it's like an old friend, and it makes hiking fun. And it's also, it makes you realize how glorious our world is, and that's why we're all here. So I'll leave this list. I'm not sure why we have a sign up. It's not like I'm going to take, but I think it was just to get an idea of how
just
many are going to come. And we'll post this up on the ARC too, just so we know how we're going to divvy up. But Craig, one of us can be in the front, one can be in the back. And
you mean the hike?
Yeah, that'll just be at the kiosk or something. Yeah, meet at the hike house. I think that's the best place to meet at around 10:15.
Can you pack a lunch tonight? I didn't know you could do that. I mean, obviously,
in the morning.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Starting at about 6:15, there's stuff out to pack for lunch.
There's stuff.
If you go, if you get up and go to the Myers Park, there's a little better lunch stuff.
And what else?
It's a secret, so no exciting.
Inside information.
I'm not up early. I usually
have
work.
If you set your watch back,
I never I am mentally on Minnesota time. I never left. So it's really nice.
I just stay on Central Time.
Yeah.
If you want salty potato chips, what time do you have to get there, Paul?
I don't know. I think I got the last package.
You did?
That was about 6:15. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you.